Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for August 2010. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. Patent litigation in the United States is expensive, in part because of the way patent claims are construed. First, there's a Markman hearing, then there's usually a jury trial. Then the Court of Appeal for the Federal Circuit gives claim construction a de novo review. In about 50% of the cases the Federal Circuit overturns, at least in part, the trial judge's claim construction and sends the matter back down for a new trial. My guest for this podcast is Frederick Whitmer, a partner in the New York office of Kilpatrick Stockton, LLP. Fred Whitmer is a litigator and concentrates his practice on IP matters, particularly patent litigation. Fred wrote an in-depth article on claim construction in the July and August 2010 issue of the magazine Landslide, the publication of the IP section of the American Bar Association. In his article, Fred analyzes the Markman decision from the U.S. Supreme Court and its offspring, the 1998 decision in Sibor, and offers a solution to the uncertainty that the Sibor decision has spawned. I spoke with Fred from his office in New York City. Hello, Fred.
Hi, Don.
In your article, you note that the Court of Appeal for the Federal Circuit overturns about 50% of appeals relating to claim construction. Is that because the district courts get it wrong half the time, or is it because the Federal Circuit can do a de novo review of claim construction on appeals?
Well, I think, Don, that the answer to that is that the de novo review is responsible for the 50% rule. A federal judge in the United States said on a public platform that I was on that in the context of, let's say, contract interpretation, federal judges in the United States are affirmed 80% of the time and reversed 20% of the time. And he wondered why it seemed that they were 30% stupider in the context of interpreting patents. And his conclusion was that they weren't, but rather that the Court of Appeals had a great freer hand in overturning patent claim construction because there is no deference given to the interpretation given by a district judge.
You say this problem began with the Sibor case in 1998. How did that start everything?
The Sibor case, which followed the Supreme Court decision in Markman, in my judgment, misreads Markman's Supreme Court ruling in the following way. The Supreme Court ultimately concluded that claim construction was a matter for the court and did so after a very extended analysis of what the process of construing claims is and what the impact of the constitutional requirements of the Seventh Amendment with respect to jury trials would have on that, ultimately concluding that this was an exercise for the court. They did not say, however, in my judgment, that it was a matter of law, which of course is always for the court and never for a jury. The distinction seems a very technical one, and in some respects it is, but it is I think best illustrated by the fact that in applications for preliminary injunctions in the United States, trial judges conduct hearings all the time, make findings of fact and conclusions of law in deciding whether to grant or deny a preliminary injunction, and the exercise of those fact findings is for the court. There is no jury. There is no right to a jury, and there never has been a right to a jury. So that it is not that somehow it is a matter of law in the same way that the judges have the right to say what any particular section of the United States Judicial Code means or some other statute, but rather it's an administrative function, effectively, for the court. By saying it's a matter of law in Sibor, the Federal Circuit freed itself to conduct de novo review of the claim construction rulings, meaning that if two out of three judges on a Federal Circuit panel disagree with the way a district judge has construed claims, they are free, simply on the basis of that disagreement, to reverse. If the standard were the same as it is on an appeal of a preliminary injunction, they would be constrained to the following. They would be constrained to see if the district judge had applied the correct law, namely whatever the Federal Circuit has said are the rules for claim construction. If the judge has applied the correct law, then the question is his conclusions with respect to claim construction supported by the evidence before him? If there was evidence that supports the claim, the judge's claim, irrespective of whether the Court of Appeals might conclude differently, they would be constrained to affirm because the standard would be clearly erroneous as to facts or contrary to law as to law. If, in fact, there is substantial evidence to support the conclusion, there would have to be an affirmance. This is why there is an 80% affirmance rate in matters other than claim construction.
You mention in your paper the recent Federal Circuit decision in Phillips that held that the words in a claim are supposed to be defined firstly with reference to the language of the patent documents themselves, and secondly with less reliance on dictionaries or other extrinsic tools. But there seemed to be a real crack in the court and a very strongly worded minority decision of Judges Mayer and Newman that seemed to support your decision. They said that it was, quote, futility, indeed an absurdity, in adhering to the falsehood that claim construction is a matter of law devoid of any factual component, end quote. What point were Judges Mayer and Newman trying to make?
Well, I think that what the judges in the dissent were trying to say is that there's always a factual component to the definition of terms in claims, and judges hear competing experts, sometimes in affidavits, sometimes in live testimony. They hear competing arguments with respect to construction based on those facts, and there is always a factual component as to what a term means. For example, what's the intent of the applicant in using a specific term? We all know that ancient maxim that the patentee can be his own lexicographer. Well, that's a factual determination. Did the applicant mean that the word widget had, for example, has a specific meaning for purposes of the patent that may be different or nuanced from the general or ordinary meaning? And what judges, I think, Mayer and Newman were saying in dissent, is that to call it a matter of law in a patent is in fact blind to the necessary factual investigation and findings that would support conclusions.
I've heard stories about U.S. judges doing claim construction totally devoid of any factual investigation, any evidence from the people skilled in the art as to what terms mean in their business. Is that always the case, sometimes the case, or what is the situation as far as the procedure of Markman hearings?
An unfortunate but common problem with respect to Markman hearings is that there is, in fact, no uniform method or procedure that has been laid down for how Markman hearings should be conducted or when they should be conducted. I've appeared before judges who say, all I want as evidence is the patent and the prosecution history, and then I'll take argument. And sometimes that process happens right at the beginning of the case, so the judge can tell the parties what he thinks how the claim is going to be interpreted so they can be guided accordingly for discovery. Sometimes it happens at the end of the case. Sometimes judges have tutorials on the technology and sometimes off the record, sometimes on the record. Sometimes there's testimony, sometimes there's not. Sometimes there's affidavits only. Sometimes there are no affidavits. The lack of uniformity means that each individual judge effectively has the right and the power to determine how that particular judge is going to handle the cases, and the lack of uniformity makes it difficult in some respects for the Court of Appeals to deal with these issues. The fact also is that because Markman rulings, claim construction rulings, are not subject to appeal before final judgment, a case can go all the way through verdict and decision, and then and only then are the claim construction rulings subject to review by the Court of Appeals. So this is a further issue here, especially with the uncertainty that the 50% reversal rate gives to the claim construction process.
In your paper, you do a detailed analysis of Markman and how the Supreme Court addressed the question that was posed to them and how they answered it. The question that was posed to them was whether the interpretation of a patent claim is a matter of law reserved entirely for the court or subject to a Seventh Amendment guarantee that a jury will determine the meaning of any disputed term of art on which expert testimony is offered. And the answer that they gave was, we hold that the construction of a patent, including terms of art within its claim, is exclusively within the province of the court. You point out that the Supreme Court never said that the exercise of claim construction was purely one of law without any fact-finding. I wonder if you could expand on that and explain what the effect of this over-reading of Markman has been.
Sure. The phrase, and I'm glad you quoted it, that it's exclusively within the province of the court. It is exclusively within the province of the court means it's been assigned to the court. The analysis in Markman, the very lengthy analysis in Markman that went through the Seventh Amendment concerns, is indicative of why I believe it is not a matter of law. Because if, in fact, the Supreme Court had said, well, this is easy. This is the construction of the patent claim is a matter of law. Matters of law have never been assigned to the jury. They would not have been subject to the Seventh Amendment jury trial right. And therefore, once you conclude that it's a matter of law, you don't have to do the Seventh Amendment analysis. It's only when there is a fact-finding component to the exercise that is under consideration, or the claim that's under consideration, that you have to see, under traditional rules of constitutional construction, does the Seventh Amendment require that this function be within the province of the jury? It was only after the Supreme Court made that lengthy Seventh Amendment analysis that they said, no, this is not something that is within the province of the jury, but this is, for reasons that I lay out in greater detail in my article, this is exclusively within the province of the court. The Federal Circuit in Sibor read this language to say it's exclusively within the province of the court as being a directive that it was a matter of law, which introduced the ability of the Court of Appeals to use a de novo standard, which created what I've called in my article the Sibor uncertainty principle, sort of building off of von Heisenberg's famous uncertainty principle.
You say in your article that there appears no jurisprudential, constitutional, or other public policy reason to disallow fact-finding in the context of claim construction from the deference ordinarily afforded such activity. That's the clearly erroneous standard. Could you expand further on what you said?
Sure. It seems to me that in many respects, the construction of a patent claim is no different from an intellectual standpoint from the construction of a contract term, for example. Many times there's an analogy drawn for that a patent is somehow a, a contract between the sovereign and an applicant to grant him a legal monopoly in exchange for the consideration of having publicly disclosed his invention. So in a construction of a contract term, the Court of Appeals give district judges deference with respect to fact finding. Judge says, this is what this contract means, and I find that this is what it means, and here's the evidence that I have for doing it, and here's the law of the claim of the contract interpretation that I've used. And again, if the judge has applied the right law and there's evidence to support his finding, even if the Court of Appeals thinks that, I might have come out differently were it me to decide in the first instance, nevertheless they give deference. I find it difficult to construct an argument that says that district judges' constructions of contract terms are entitled to deference, but not of patent terms. There are enormously complicated and difficult and arcane instruments that are construed by courts every day that are as challenging as the construction of the patent claims. And to grant deference to one and not the other in this circumstance, I think, is unjustified.
How would a district court judge differentiate between those two types of findings, the findings of fact and the findings of law, in order to make his or her claim construction or Markman decision a little more appeal-proof?
I think I again draw the analogy of the preliminary injunction application, and I'll do a short run through the preliminary injunction, for example, and then compare it to how I would see it being done with the patent. In the traditional setting for preliminary injunction, an applicant comes in and says, I need a preliminary injunction because I have a substantial likelihood of success of winning on the merits of this case, and without a preliminary injunction, I'm going to be irreparably harmed. The district judge holds a hearing and says, here's what the law is that underlies the claim. With respect to that claim, I find the following facts, and those facts are A, B, and C. And as a result of that, I conclude that there is irreparable harm to the plaintiff if I don't grant an injunction, and the reasons for that are D, E, and F. And therefore, by applying the prevailing law, I grant the injunction. The Court of Appeals looks at this and says, well, the prevailing law is A, B, and C. He's right about that. He says that there's irreparable harm because of D, E, and F. He's right about that because those are the standards of law. And the evidence, there is evidence in the record that supports his findings with respect to the likelihood of success on the merits. And therefore, since his findings are not clearly erroneous, they have evidence to support them, and because he's applied the right law, we affirm. Now, let's take that to the claim construction area. The district judge would say the claim term that we have to construe here is the word widget, and I have evidence that says a widget means X from the plaintiff, and I have the evidence from the defendant that says widget means Y. And I conclude on the basis of the reading the specification, which says whatever it says, and I have the patent, and I look at the claim terms, and I looked at the prosecution history, and I conclude as a result of this that the defendant's construction of Y with respect to widget is a better interpretation, and therefore it is Y is the interpretation I'm going to give on the word widget. Then the Court of Appeals would look at this and say, all right, the district judge has followed our rules in terms of claim construction. He's looked at the specification. He's looked at the patent. He's heard what people of ordinary skill in the arts say about it. And he has decided that the evidence that is in the specification and in the patent are better supported, better support the interpretation that has been forwarded by the defendant, and we therefore find that he's not clearly erroneous on the law, and there's evidence that supports his finding, therefore we affirm. So that the process would again be the district judge trying to follow the rules of claim construction, looking at the evidence that's appropriate before him, and then determining what the interpretation should be. If he has followed the right rules and there's evidence to support his interpretation, it would support affirmance. He would have to be clearly erroneous as to the application of law, or for there to be no evidence to support his definition in order for there to be a reversal.
Up in Canada here, expert witnesses are not supposed to tell the court what they think the claims mean, because that's the job of the judge. But what they are allowed to testify with respect to is, what do the terms mean in the art? What would they have meant to a person skilled in the art at the relevant time? What was the prior art, and what was the universe of the invention? What was the state of the industry? And I can see those being completely factual circumstances that a judge might be able to make a determination on, as to say, what did the term widget mean to a person skilled in the art outside the context of the patent? And that might be sort of the second category of reference referred to in the Phillips decision. But then the court could ask itself, is this term widget being used in any special way in the patent, or have they tweaked the word in the context of the patent to give it a different meaning other than what its ordinary outside meaning might be? And that would be, to quote the Supreme Court in Markman, something that's within the province of the court, or even a matter of law at that point, to determine whether the contract has tweaked it. Can you see a bifurcation of that sort of decision making being helpful to a district court in nailing down those corners of the tent?
Yes, I do, and in fact, although there's somewhat of an artificiality about making an expert to say, well, I don't know what it means in this patent, I can't testify to that, but I can tell you what somebody, an ordinary person of ordinary skill in the art would say. That's really the kind of testimony you elicit, because what you try to get is an expert on the stand who is qualified to be an expert, is found to be a person of ordinary skill in the art, and they then testify about what does this language mean to me. In effect, not the intent of the draftsman, but rather, as I read it, what does it mean to me? What do these words mean to me? What would I take from this? And that would be the evidence, in part, that the district judge would use in reaching a claim construction. It must always be remembered that one of the principal teachings of the Phillips case, for example, is that one looks at the specification and the patent, the four corners of the patent, are the important meets and bounds of the definitional aspects, and you go to prosecution history also as what is called intrinsic evidence to determine what is the meaning of this term within the patent. One of the other examples that I've used, which I think is relevant to say here, is if you take the word, and again we've been using widget as sort of the generic word, widget may mean a different thing in patent one from patent two, but if it were a matter of law what widget meant, why wouldn't widget always mean the same thing no matter which patent it was in?
It'd be in Black's Law Dictionary.
Indeed, but widget in fact has a meaning within the four corners of the patent in which it's found, and in order to find that meaning, does indeed require specific fact-finding with respect to that patent and the words used in that patent.
Your article has a ray of hope in it, and you make reference to a recent case, the Trading Technologies case, where Chief Justice Rader expressed misgivings about the de novo standard of review for claim construction appeals. Are things starting to change, or what's needed to affect the change that you'd like to see?
Well, the answer is, are they starting to change? No, I haven't. I think it's a little early to judge that they're starting to change. But I do think that the problem, and it is a problem, the problem of the lack of deference to a district court's finding is one that's so commonly recognized that something needs to happen. And the suggestion that I've made here in my article doesn't fundamentally change the way things will proceed in the district court, and it doesn't radically change the approach of how district judges go about doing claim construction. What it will do is add, or I should say lessen, in the uncertainty and add some greater level of certainty to what district judges do. I know one district judge, for example, who, contrary to the what you might think is the ordinary requirement of findings of fact and conclusions of law, simply puts out an order for a Markman after you've had full briefing, basically says, for purposes of this case, the following terms are defined as follows, so ordered. And the reason that it is done that way without any background analysis and argument, at least, is that district judges are busy and they've got lots of things to do. And since there's no deference given to their fact findings with respect to how they construe these claims, it's needless to go through the effort of having a more extended opinion. If a district judge were confident that the ruling has a greater likelihood of being affirmed, and that, in fact, he's not just a way station on the way to the Court of Appeals, I think that you may even have a more careful approach to the claim construction process, although by no means think that people believe that district judges do these things haphazardly. They don't. They put a lot of time and effort and energy into their efforts, but I think they would see them as being more useful and not potentially a waste of time on the basis of the de novo review.
Fred, your article has been out for, I guess, a month or so. What sort of reaction have you had from friends, colleagues, or potential enemies?
I've gotten actually a number of comments, people who've read the article and have commented that they liked it or had questions about it. But one is particularly amusing and I think actually enlightening. I got a call from a friend of mine who expressed the fact that he thought my analysis was correct and argued in a way that persuaded him that I was probably correct as to how this should be handled. In the context of he said the only thing he was afraid of was that, in fact, my article would be adopted, and this would become a province of the court subject to the clearly erroneous and contrary to law standard, which would truncate his appellate practice, he thought, because people have greater incentive to pursue appeals if they think they have a 50-50 shot as opposed to having a 20-80 shot. He said it jocularly, but he clearly believed it, as do I, that by having a 50-50 shot, it extends uncertainty, gives a greater opportunity for people to be enthusiastic about the potential of appeal. But if they face the 20-80 standard, maybe the district court ruling would be greater, followed more frequently, and lead to settlements.
As the old expression goes, be careful what you wish for.
Indeed.
Thank you very much, Fred. Much appreciated.
My pleasure. Thanks, Don.
My guest for this podcast has been Fred Whitmer, a patent litigator with Kilpatrick Stockton LLP in New York City. For further information regarding Fred's article entitled Claim Construction in Patent Cases, A Question of Law, An Exploration of the Sibor Uncertainty Principle, and information on other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You have been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick, LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.